From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and we're following news today of this horrific attack in Egypt. More than 230 people are dead and more than 100 wounded after a bomb exploded at a mosque in the Sinai Peninsula. It happened as worshippers were finishing Friday prayers. The BBC's Sally Nabil joins us now from Cairo. And Sally, what do we know so far?
This is by all means an unprecedented attack in northern Sinai, whether when it comes to the scale of the attack or the style. The number of the victims is absolutely huge. And if we know what happened, this kind of explains why the number keeps rising. What we know so far is that a bomb went off not far from a mosque that had worshippers going to Friday prayers. And after the bomb went off, a number of militants armed with automatic rifles, they walked into the mosque and they started shooting randomly at everyone they saw. And there were also another group of militants in the street shooting at passers-by. They even targeted ambulance cars that rushed to the scene to save people. So it was a very well orchestrated, huge attack. And we understand that some of the victims are in quite a critical condition. So perhaps the death toll will keep rising over the next few hours.
Yeah, the images from the scene are horrifying. Photos of the dead lined up inside the mosque. It appears to be a Sufi mosque. Could that be a reason why the attackers targeted it?
It's hard to say why the attackers targeted it. As I said, the style of the attack is unprecedented. Militants have been operating in northern Sinai. They usually target police forces and army forces. They also targeted Christians. I mean, over the past couple of months, they forced a large number of Christians to flee the area for fear of their lives. But this is the first time they target worshippers inside a mosque. And it's worth mentioning that Friday is a weekend in Egypt, and Friday noon prayers, they are a religious obligation. So a lot of usually men go to the Friday prayers and they have their children with them. It lasts for about 15 to 20 minutes. So this kind of explains why as well we have a number of children among the victims. So far, no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but there are lots of questions actually about the effectiveness of the security operation in northern Sinai. Military forces, they have been battling the militants for 3-4 years now, and every now and then happens an attack, but on the other side, there are some people who say you cannot force a cordon around the mosque to make people feel safe. It is just a house of worship, and people usually go there to pray. You cannot force a security cordon around every single mosque in the area.
Right. Now, no group, as you say, has claimed responsibility yet, but we do know the militants operating in that area of the Sinai are affiliates of the Islamic State. Tell us more about who is causing the unrest there in that region.
It's a group affiliated, as you said, it's a group affiliated with the so-called Islamic State, and it's called the Sinai Province. But every now and then we hear about new offshoots coming from this umbrella group, and the frequency of the attacks that happen in northern Sinai kind of reflects that the militants have been gaining ground over the past couple of years. Although the army have been trying to hit hard, launching airstrikes, and they do attack the militant hideouts every now and then, but it seems that the militants, they are gaining ground because they manage not just to target military forces, but now they have been targeting civilians, and they have been widening the scope of their attacks. It's not just Christians anymore. They are hitting, or they are targeting everybody, and this is what we see on social media as well, because some people have been saying it's not just churches anymore. It's everybody. They are within the fire range of the militants at the moment.
You're speaking to us from Cairo. Of course, the Egyptian government is very concerned about this. The security forces have been trying to crack down against these militants in the Sinai Peninsula. From your perspective there in Cairo, what is the government doing, and how are people across the country responding to this news?
Maybe the shocking thing is that people some sort of got used to the frequency of the attacks. But today's attack is different because it happened inside the mosque and there are so many people killed and wounded. This brings a lot of shock to people here. As for the government, we know that President Sisi, he chaired a Council for National Security, and they will try to look into measures that could be taken to possibly find the perpetrators, because they are still they couldn't find the perpetrators so far, and perhaps to avoid the repetition of such painful scenarios in the future. And 3 days of national mourning have been announced, but there are really a lot of suspicion whether security forces and military forces will be able to stop these kinds of attacks in the future, because so far, from what we have seen, they keep happening.
The BBC's Sally Nabil in Cairo. Sally, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're going to keep an eye on that story as it develops. In this country, it has been almost exactly 3 months since Hurricane Harvey unleashed about 60 inches of rain on Houston. And people there are still trying to recover from the flooding that followed. For Houstonians with HIV and AIDS, the storm was especially harrowing. As Sarah Varney from Kaiser Health News reports, many victims not only lost their homes, but also access to life-saving medications.
Angela Solomon watched out the window of her ranch house in northeast Houston as the floodwaters rose up to the windowsills. She huddled inside with her three adopted children, ages 12 to 15, a nephew, and her 68-year-old mother.
They were looking, they crying, you know, like, we're going to lose everything. My mom said, no, it'll be okay.
When the water began rushing under the front door, filling up the house like a bathtub, Solomon led her family outside and plunged into a river of water up to her chest. She recorded their escape on her cell phone.
We should have stayed at home. Ain't nowhere to go. Ooh, Lord, what is this on my leg? Oh, Lord, have mercy. Look at my poor mama, wet in this water like this.
The hurricane could not have come at a worse time for the 47-year-old single mother, who was diagnosed with HIV in 2011. Just before the storm, in a troubling sign, her T-cell count, the cells that the HIV virus kills, had plummeted from the stress of losing her job. She had used her last unemployment check to buy school clothes and supplies that now faced certain ruin in the floodwaters.
It was like 5 feet of water. We just lost everything, cars, everything.
Everything was destroyed, including her HIV medication. When I met Solomon in Houston, it had been a month since she took her last HIV pill. There were just too many crises to contend with, dealing with FEMA to rebuild her house, finding a car, enrolling her kids in another school district.
It wasn't on my mind because I have so much other stuff to do with the kids, trying to get a ride.
That was the case for many Texans with HIV. The hurricane closed pharmacies and clinics for a week or longer. Floodwaters ruined people's medicines. Those who fled to nearby states, like Georgia, couldn't get their HIV medication prescriptions filled. As the days ticked on, many worried the amount of HIV in their blood would increase and become resistant to treatment.
My name is Donnell Walker. We're standing in front of our house.
The water was about 4 feet. First time in 52 years it's ever been flooded.
Donnell Walker waited out the storm with his 12 brothers and sisters outside of Houston. The 52-year-old former fashion designer left his HIV medication behind, assuming he'd be back to his house the next day. A week later, when he finally made it back, everything was gone.
My biggest emotion was racing in the house to check for my medication because I hadn't had it, and it was underwater because it was in my nightstand, and my nightstand was floating.
Walker went to his pharmacy the first day it reopened, but he went nearly 2 weeks without his HIV drugs.
On top of all of this disaster, I could possibly die and have that burden on top of my family.
He says he feared for his life, not only from the missed doses, but because HIV had weakened his immune system.
I had been around a lot of flood waters. I didn't know if I had gotten hepatitis or, you know, I didn't know what my condition was.
There are some 25,000 people with HIV and AIDS living in Houston and Harris County. Dr. Thomas Giordano, medical director at Thomas Street, a public HIV clinic here, says it will take months to determine, through a series of blood tests, if his patients' viral loads have been affected by the storm. Giordano, though, worries most about his patients who haven't made it back to the clinic. Hurricane Harvey upended so many lives, scattering people off to live with friends or family who may not know their status.
A lot of people don't want their friends or their extended family to know they have HIV, and so they can't get the assistance they might need to get to the pharmacy to get a refill or to take their medicines with their meals. And so a lot of them just sort of stay undercover until things are stabilized again.
Can I help the next patient here at 5?
Angela Solomon, the single mother who waded through the waters with her family, finally found a ride to the county clinic to refill her HIV prescription.
I have your Complair already, and I also have your Levicin. Do you need something else?
No.
Just those two?
Solomon walks toward the clinic exit with her medicine in her purse. Outside, it's pouring rain.
Oh, God.
I ask her where she's headed next. Back to her sister's house, she says, where she and her kids are living with 16 other relatives until her house is fixed up. She doesn't feel relief or even hope, she says. There's still too much to do. I'm Sarah Varney in Houston.
And every year around this time, we take a moment to annoy people who can't stand change, especially change to the English language. The American Heritage Dictionaries is out with its list of new words for 2017. We'll put it up at hereandnow.org. Steve Kleinedler is with us now in the studio. He's the dictionary's executive editor. He's got a stack of new words with him. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So should we call you a wordsmith?
Well, you can call me a wordsmith.
Okay, well, Mr. Wordsmith, how about this one? Orthorexia.
Orthorexia. That is one of the many words that we added this year, and it refers to excessive preoccupation with one's dietary choices, especially with regard to the purity or healthfulness of the food one eats. We like to talk about food words every year, and this ties into that, especially with the rise of internet sites that are geared towards this kind of thing, as well as all of the food channels. People are very conscious about what they eat, and if you kind of overdo it, you might have orthorexia.
Well, I thought that's exactly why I thought it would be an appropriate word to start with today, a day when many of us may not know that word, but we're certainly feeling it.
At first, it was almost extremely jocular, you know, on modeled afterwards like anorexia. But it's actually being used in serious discourse now. It started off kind of as a joke word, but now it's something that is used seriously to discuss this phenomenon.
We're going to get deeper in this list, but
awesome.
First, let's talk about why you do this every year. Because whether you like it or not, Languages change.
Absolutely, language is changing, and there are a lot of companies that put out their word of the year, which ends up being, it's subjective. There's a lot of possibilities, and I think it's a richer discussion to talk about all the material that has been added, because we're not only adding new words and senses. This is all part of a holistic overview where we're also reviewing and revising existing material. And so these tie into like the areas that we're looking at. And, you know, if we're looking at new psychology terms or biopharmaceutical terms or whatever, we balance that with some of these words that come in with into the pop culture mainstream.
Well, how about this one related to that? Burner.
Yes.
Which, you know, a lot of people will see this list and they'll say, well, I've been hearing the word burner for years, ever since The Wire came out on HBO. We've been hearing about that word.
Right. Sometimes there's a lag time before a word starts being used casually and before it's entered into a dictionary. Part of that is there's just a lot of material out of there, a lot of stuff coming into usage. But also before we enter a word, we want to make sure it's got staying power, that it's going to stick around for a while, that it's not some fad that comes and goes. So a burner is an inexpensive cell phone, especially one for which usage is paid in advance and which can be thrown away easily if necessary. It's now used even beyond, you know, your spy thrillers, your sci-fi books, that kind of thing. And it's got enough provenance that it's worth putting in, and we did.
Well, some of the words are not necessarily new. We've been using them for a long time, but they take on new meaning. I'm looking at this one here, unicorn.
Yes, unicorn, which has two new senses, one of which is the one people are less interested in. That's a startup company valued at $1 billion or more.
Right.
The more commonly new sense is something that is greatly desired but difficult or impossible to find.
So use unicorn in a sentence.
Right. As part of our program, program, we try to use exact quotations where possible, and we have one here. Is anti-gravity the unicorn of physics, or do we simply lack the strategy and bait to catch it with an experimental snare? Which was written by a science editor named Jerome Groopman.
Okay, wow. So, that is a sentence I never would have written, but that's somebody did, right?
Someone
there,
did, yeah. And so anti-gravity can be seen as a unicorn in that regard.
What about this one? Snowflake. Now, that is a word that is kind of controversial, and it's caught on in American politics.
Yes, snowflake, or a special snowflake. Obviously, the word snowflake is an old English word. It's been around for quite a while. The newer sense that's come into meaning, and it's defined neutrally, so you can use it in a variety of contexts, but a snowflake would be a person who is considered to be overly sensitive or too easily offended, especially as a result of believing himself or herself to be unique or special.
Now, we have done a lot of reporting on politics on this program over the many years. And when we're on the road talking to people, this word will actually come up. The right, and I would say probably the far right, will use this phrase to insult liberals, and it can be very insulting to some people.
Yes, it is a word that not only is the far right using of liberals, but even middle of the road people using for people further right than they are, people on the left using for people who are further left, and then conversely throwing it back into the face of the far right. I think the preponderance of evidence would be that of the far right using it to describe liberals, but you'll see it in a variety of contexts, and that's one of the reasons why it's defined neutrally.
What do you think is happening in the language when that word takes on such a life of its own?
I think it takes on a life of its own because it's such an interesting metaphor. A snowflake, a special snowflake, is someone or something that melts under pressure. I think part of what's driving it is the vivid metaphor behind it. And, you know, on the surface, it's not a swear word. It's not a slur. You know, it's meant to dig underneath the skin and hurt and twist the knife and that sort of thing. So I think it's a word that people use in a manipulative way often, and they can get away with it because it's a relatively benign term.
Well, also related to politics is the word self-care.
Self-care has actually been around for a little longer than just a year, but it's certainly got an uptick after the election last year, and people were getting burned out on news stories and just the reality of situation as it started to sink in. People who were, you know, addicted to social media and on all hours of the day and in kind of this feedback loop, and, you know, causing a lot of angst and stress. And people are encouraged in that environment to make sure that they indulge in or partake of self-care, which is the act of engaging in activities or behaviors that help one achieve or maintain good physical or mental health, especially to mitigate the effects of stress or trauma.
Now, do you know this word is making its way into the zeitgeist because people are searching for it online?
Well, they're not only searching for it online, but they're also using it so that when we are looking at not just raw Google searches or Twitter searches, that kind of thing, but its use in newspaper articles online, in journals, that kind of thing. It is definitely part of the zeitgeist, not just because people are looking it up, but also because editors and writers are actually using it in their editing and writing.
Upcycle.
Yes. So that is to recycle, you know, something that's broken, something that's worn out, that kind of thing, by repurposing it to create a useful or aesthetically pleasing new product. For example, using vibrant paint, I upcycled the wine bottle into a vase. We just recently added that. It'll be online in our online dictionary in January. We've gone from recycling to upcycling, you know, just the whole reuse aspect of that.
Do you think it will become as common as its cousin recycle?
If things get really Hunger Games and apocalyptic, we'll have no choice, right? You know, reusing what we've got. I think recycling will probably remain the more predominant term simply because it's so ubiquitous and it's something that is just entrenched in the systems, the municipal systems across the country. Upcycling is probably more of a fringe at the moment Etsy craft project type of activity.
Now, in addition to the new words, you also have a usage panel. And that looks at the way that words are used in everyday life. And also, some of this is fascinating, changes in pronunciations. And it looks like you had a couple of them this year. So let's start with, I'm going to just spell this word, okay? Because I don't want to say it for you. S-T-A-T-E. U.S.
Ah, yes. You'll undoubtedly hear it pronounced both status and status.
I will never say it as status, okay. By the way.
Yes. And you'd be in the majority now, too. We've surveyed this several times over the past several decades. And in our 2016 survey, 85% of the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel preferred the pronunciation status and 15% preferred status, although both forms were considered acceptable by large margins. This is a noticeable shift from our 1997 survey, which was the first time the panelists by a narrow margin preferred status over status. The pronunciation status is the older pronunciation, and it remains the one most common in British English.
Okay, so you're still allowed to say status. It is preferred if you say status, or it's more common to say status.
It's more common, yes.
Also, internet. No longer must be capitalized.
No longer must be capitalized. Like the AP and several other outlets, the move has been towards lowercasing internet. And now for the first time, we as well have lowercase internet, not only online, but in the next printing of the print dictionary, the internets are going to be lowercased.
Okay. Well, from a guy who spends a lot of time copy editing, thank you for that one. We've been speaking with Steve Kleinedler, a guy you do not want to go head-to-head in a game of Scrabble with. He's the executive editor of American Heritage Dictionaries, talking about the new words that came into the lexicon in 2017. Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, Siri.
Hi there, Peter.
Define snowflake.
A flake of snow, especially a feathery ice crystal, typically displaying delicate six-fold symmetry.
Define burner.
A person or thing that burns. Do you want to hear the next one?
Yes, yes.
Short for CD burner. Want to hear the next one?
Okay.
An inexpensive mobile phone for whose telecommunications services one pays in advance, used typically for the sake of anonymity since no personal details are required by the service provider.
Yes, that was it!
The last one?
No, you got it. You're good.
Done.
Siri, repeat after me. This is Here and Now.
I don't think I like this game.
Let's go to Los Angeles, where NPR's Sonari Glinton has been standing in the parking lot of a Toys R Us all morning long. Today is the official start of the holiday shopping season, but Sonari retail analysts have been saying that Black Friday has sort of been losing some of its shine in recent years. Have you been noticing that in the parking lot?
Well, I'm actually in the store right now.
Oh, great, good.
I'm around the Legos. Yeah, Black Friday is actually gaining some steam. What's losing steam are things like Gray Thursday and what was Gray Wednesday, meaning opening up earlier and earlier. Consumers have essentially rejected that, and it looks like the busiest time here or in stores is going to be at about noon on Black Friday.
You've been talking to people, I imagine, while they come into the store. What's like the big toy that everybody wants in 2017, the Tickle Me Elmo 2017?
Well, that's the thing about this year. There is no Tickle Me Elmo. There's a Learn From Me Elmo, or there's a version of Live and Learn Elmo, I think, or something like that. There's not like a big toy necessarily from the Hasbros and Mattels. There's some of these more bespoke toys, LOL, Big Surprise, which is a ball of toys, and you don't really know what you're going to get when you go in. That's one of the big ones. Hoverboards are big, and of course,
again, yeah.
Barbie has a townhouse, so that's a big one, too.
Okay, that sounds fun. But, you know, it has been a pretty tough year for retailers. Toys R Us, where you are right now, filed for bankruptcy just a few months ago. How important will the next few weeks of the holiday season be for them?
Well, the holiday season is important for everyone, but Toys R Us is sort of in, you know, more difficult straits. They have done well in bankruptcy. But one of the problems is that, you know, the Star Wars franchise and the Harry Potter franchise are kind of old. And so they're not, you know, driving the excitement for, you know, the Legos and all the branded toys. And you could almost say that Star Wars is, and, you know, this holiday season is sort of keeping Toys R Us going longer than it probably should. I mean, like, I'm in a toy store, and it is not, like, the most kid-friendly or participation-friendly experience, right?
Really?
You
what
can
do you
imagine.
Mean? Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I'm standing in a, you know, there are just rows and rows of toys, and in almost every other way, right, we can experience them, we can play with them, and that is where we're going to towards in general in retail. If I can, get all of these Legos on Amazon or on in Walmart, but when you come to the store, you want some expertise, you want some time, and that's where you're going to get the extra sale. And the stores that are doing that are doing much better.
Well, and that's the issue that retail is facing across the board, right? I mean, it's got this huge competition from people just going online to go shopping. So when you look at what is going to happen down the road with the industry, what are analysts saying how the rest of the year will shape up?
Well, we got a little few extra days. The economy is good. The unemployment is good. The stock market is doing well. So we expect a decent holiday season, but we're still going to see mobile eating into the sales and of brick and mortar retailers. It's just hard out here for a big box retailer.
All right. NPR's Sonari Glinton on the scene from a Toys R Us in Los Angeles. Go get some food, Sonari. Rest up.
Oh, I need it. Thanks.
Senator Al Franken issued a Thanksgiving Day apology to the women who've accused him of unwanted sexual advances. The Democrat from Minnesota said yesterday he felt terribly that he's made some women feel badly. He also apologized to his constituents. The list of powerful men accused of sexually harassing and sexually assaulting women has grown considerably in the past few weeks. But the fact is that sexual assault and other forms of misconduct have a long history in the United States, especially in the workforce. For a look back at this, we're joined now by Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. And Nathan, start with you. One of the better-known examples from early American history of powerful men taking advantage of women is Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. She was the slave who gave birth to six of his children. But is it right to say that at that time, very few women, slave or free, had recourse against sexually abusive men?
Well, the laws around protection for women were basically, you know, an echo of what the laws were protecting slaves, which were basically, you know, only insofar as a person was considered property. And so much of the law protecting women in the workplace had to do with whether or not they were being, you know, deflowered or spoiled as potential, you know, bartering instruments in families that were trying to marry off daughters or, you know, to bear children. So the law really for women in much of the 19th century was about the usefulness, the kind of, you know, value of women to their fathers primarily. And so there's a whole area of law where women are forced to basically make claims about being damaged as people who belong to these families. And so it's very much an echo of how slaves had to try to make their claims if they were damaged by being rented out by their master to an employer, which, again, is not anything that really does reflect the fullness of, you know, a woman's personhood.
And right, of course. And in that case, it would probably be the father who would win any damages in any legal proceedings.
Yeah, there's an 1858 case, Dane versus Wyckoff in New York. The father sues his daughter's employer, she's 14, for getting her pregnant and thus losing her income when she has to quit and have the baby. The irony, of course, is that as women's opportunities continued to expand across the 19th century for work outside the home, work in which some of the rewards at least might be their own, these problems of sexual abuse and assault and harassment grew apace. And so even as the industrialization grows, so do the problems presented by men being in power over women. So it really takes off and never subsides. You know, every opportunity seems to be accompanied by another problem.
When did the term sexual harassment come to be?
Well, sexual harassment really is a term that was used in the 1970s to try to raise consciousness. An attorney by the name of Lynn Fairley tried to basically get the idea that harassment, you know, was a kind of discrimination. So you have to imagine, Peter, that the legal landscape is one in which people are making a variety of claims. And at the time, coming out of the 1960s, the principal way in which people talked about discrimination was very much rooted in the history of the civil rights movement. Mm. And there's a reason for that. That's actually linked very much to the history of women and the workplace, right? Because much of the story coming out of, as Ed pointed to, the factories and the work done in the progressive era, and especially through the work that was being done in the homes, oftentimes by black domestics through the Jim Crow period, was about sexual harassment. And so you find people like, for instance, Rosa Parks, who first really cut their teeth politically on trying to pursue claims against women for rape and sexual harassment in places like the Jim Crow South. Parks from Alabama, right? And so, you know, when you have a movement that then swells and gets legislation passed, as happened in the mid-1960s with the Civil Rights Act, you then find that serving as the foundation for subsequent claims by second-wave feminists like Lynn Fairley and Catherine McKinnon and others, another important legal mind, who are trying to find ways to create a broader definition of the way in which women's gender power and, again, their labor power is going to be protected in the workplace.
Well, and it's fascinating just how modern all of this is, because the first class action sexual harassment case wasn't until 1984, which is, you know, that's very much modern history.
It is. But it also, you know, bears keeping in mind that even prior to that, a lot of what would become these discrimination suits were open secrets in industries around the country, right? You think about, for instance, you know, areas like, you know, the secretaries who were being harassed by their bosses, or obviously women who are trying to break into industrial work still in the post-war period, and even Hollywood, you know, during the golden age of big pictures, the problems of gender harassment and sexual harassment in the workplace are an industry open secret.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that Judy Garland, when she's filming Wizard of Oz and Ruby Red Slippers, is having to fight off Louis B. Mayer in those very same days, and Shirley Temple. And so, you know, what all this shows is that what we're seeing now is the tip of the iceberg being exposed. And it's shocking, really, how long it took for that to be exposed to public gaze when, as Nathan says, it had been an open secret in so many industries for so long.
Well, I do want to get to what we're experiencing today, but let's just take a look at 1991 first. That was when Anita Hill testified against Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. It was huge news, watching the confirmation hearing on TV. Take us back to that time. What happened, and how are we still feeling the impacts of that today?
Well, in the wake of the resignation of Thurgood Marshall, obviously a really prominent figure in the history of American law, the president, George Herbert Walker Bush, thought to appoint another African-American, in this case Clarence Thomas, who had worked with Reagan as part of the EEOC, that's the Equal Opportunities Employment Commission, as well as in the Department of Education. And Thomas seemed pretty much like a lock. However, there was a document that was leaked to the FBI that included this mention of Thomas basically engaging in lewd behavior in the workplace. And that document mentioned Anita Hill. Congress calls Hill forward. She testifies under oath. And all of a sudden, we're having a conversation about sexual harassment, again, from the guy accused, with the accused being the former head of the EEOC, right, and an African-American man. So no small accusation whatsoever. And this particular moment in American history absolutely begins to put front and center, you know, one, what's the experience of women of color working under men of color in these, you know, environments? But also, is it even possible to take down a powerful man who's accused of some pretty, you know, horrific things?
And we should probably acknowledge Anita Hill at that point. It's 1991. She's coming forward with these allegations. She must have been going through the ringer doing that.
Well, she was, and polls showed that Americans didn't believe her by a ratio of 2-1. And so the courage to step forward and not finding, like today, that people are sort of stepping up and say, I believe the woman, but instead saying, you know, I don't believe the woman.
Right.
Well, we have, of course, President Clinton and Paula Jones in the 1990s. There's sexual assault cases in the military that we're well aware of now. The stories that we've seen with Harvey Weinstein in Hollywood, Kevin Spacey. Do you have any confidence at all, gentlemen, that history has taught us anything about this?
Well, I think one thing is clear, which is that when you have these groundswells of, you know, civic engagement and political consciousness, the legal system will, in fact, respond. I mean, again, just thinking about the case of Anita Hill, I mean, it was one thing to see Clarence Thomas still be confirmed, even in spite of Hill's testimony. But no one can argue that that moment helped to raise new consciousness about what sexual harassment meant in the workplace. There were entire groups of women who were mobilized in the wake of that episode. One group, for instance, the African-American Women in Defense of Ourselves, you know, got over 1,600 signatures just in the wake of that particular episode. And now we're seeing, you know, a new level of awareness about abuses in Hollywood, the very kinds of which, you know, Ed was describing in the 1950s. And the question really does remain, will we see a new round of organizing or, you know, women who are celebrities being able to, you know, speak and be believed in public about the accusations they're making toward their powerful male counterparts?
Ed, do you agree?
I do. And what's striking is how quickly people mobilized after Anita Hill, not just in the spirit of anger or honesty, but in lawsuits and right. mobilization, right? And so I think Nathan's right. What's amazing is how rapidly the ground can shift beneath people's feet. And think about how our language changes before it's womanizing or it's, you know, being fresh. Now right. it's being called by what it is. Those are big changes. When our language changes, often our ideas change to go along with it.
That's Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
As fears grow about robots taking our jobs, some people are asking if the government should be helping people who are put out of work. One idea is universal basic income. Essentially, the government hands out money to its citizens who are either unemployed or underemployed. Canada is actually experimenting with the idea right now. Jason Bellini at the Wall Street Journal has been looking at the issue as a part of his series Moving Upstream. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Peter.
Let's start with the argument here, the basic premise. Robots are taking over our jobs. In the future, they'll be taking over more of them. And since we'll have no way to work anymore, we'll all get paid to do nothing.
Pretty much. We can just kind of kick back. This is the optimistic version of the future. The people who are making the argument for basic income with that in mind seems to be some of the, you know, the big tech titans. We had Mark Zuckerberg talk about it at a commencement speech at Harvard. Elon Musk has talked about it. Actually was able to talk about it with Richard Branson, who's on favor of experimenting with basic income, because really it's an old concept, but it's right now kind of going through a revival in terms of interest, in particularly in Europe, in experimenting with this.
And you went to Canada, not that far from the United States at all. They've got a program that they're looking into. Their pilot began this summer. What are they doing there?
Well, there they're picking 4,000 people. And the way they're doing it is just sending out letters to people who are eligible. They're means testing it. So you have to make below a certain amount of money. And if you're one of the lucky ones chosen, you'll get up to $17,000 a year in basic income. Now, they're only doing this for 4,000 people, and it's a 3-year trial. And their hope is to find out just kind of what consequences that has for people. Do they hang out, relax, watch Netflix all day, or do they use it to better themselves, to be able to go back to school, to get themselves better job training? What kind of health implications does this have? Are people are less stressed about money? Are they more healthy? Do their medical bills go down? All kinds of things that they're trying to find out about whether this is something that should be considered by policymakers for a much larger rollout in the future.
So this is in the pilot stage in Canada. There have been other places around the world that have tried something like a universal basic income. Have we learned anything at all, either in Canada so far or in these other places, about what people actually do with their time if they're not working and they're getting paid by the government?
Not yet. And also should point out that some people are working. Let's talk about Finland's experiment with basic income, which they began last January. They decided that they're going to allow anyone to apply. And so they selected people. You know, you could be rich and still get this basic income. They started this 2-year pilot, but they're not going to release any of the data. I'm not sure exactly why that's the case, but they're doing this for 2 years, giving people about $600 a month. And how they decide whether it was successful or not, that's not entirely clear.
And what about in this country? You mentioned some of the tech firms, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. Who's thinking about this here?
Well, out in Silicon Valley, they're actually doing some trials with it. Y Combinator, that's a firm that's funding startups. They've moved ahead with this really ambitious project, and they're going to give 1,000 people $1,000 per month for up to 5 years. They're going to have about 2,000 people also receiving $50 a month as a control group, and then they'll compare the results. Also, the Economic Security Project recently announced they're going to put $1 million grant towards testing basic income in Stockton, California. So these are pretty small projects, but not funded by the government. And I think that's pretty key here because it's still a really controversial idea here. Certainly the administration isn't a fan of it. We recently heard from the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Jason Furman. He said that we should not advance a policy, talking about basic income, that's premised on giving up on the possibility of workers remaining employed. And this actually came after Charles Murray from the American Enterprise Institute, conservative, posted a editorial in the Wall Street Journal suggesting that UBI would be a good solution if you took away all the other social welfare programs, instead gave people a basic income, that it would, he says, give them a road to the middle class, and that it would, and I'm going to quote him here, said, it would say to people who have never had reason to believe it before, your future is in your hands.
Well, it does seem like it would be a difficult lift with a Republican in the White House, Republicans controlling Congress. I mean, I think even probably a lot of Democrats would have questions about how a program like this would work. But is anybody asking the question of these tech companies, you know, why should it be the government doing this when it's the tech companies who are creating the robots, creating the driverless cars? They're the ones who are driving the innovation that's affecting these jobs.
What they would say, and they have said, is that this is about scale, that it's not something that could be implemented by private corporations by themselves. But we have heard some policymakers talk about the idea of a robot tax. So when companies use more robotics, they actually have to pay for it, and that would go towards funding a basic income or some other way to redistribute that money.
That's Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal, and we'll link you to his series. It's called Moving Upstream at hereandnow.org. Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Robin and Jeremy are back on Monday. This is Here and Now.